Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me to kick off this week's episode is, and I'm going to say back by popular demand, and he's going to argue with me, Jeremy Slevin.
Well, this time it is popular demand. I mean, thousands wrote in.
You don't think it was the first time?
No.
They just didn't CC you on the emails.
I think it was the second one that really kicked it off.
Well, it's because they CC'd you this time.
Okay.
So you have become really an installation, a fixture of the show rapidly.
It only took 3 weeks.
Now this is the third. For you to give us the roundup of the news happening this week in poverty. So what's going on, Jeremy?
All right. Well, lightning round this time. Let's start. There was another debate this week. This time it was the vice presidential debate.
People thought no one was going to watch.
Right. People did watch, surprisingly. Big news out of it, not a lot of questions this time on poverty, not a lot of questions on climate change, not a lot of questions on immigration, and the questions on the economy.
I love that you said big news out of it, then you were like, things that didn't happen.
Negative news. Well, the news that was talked about, the questions that were asked about the economy were mainly about a debt crisis that doesn't really exist, and then a so-called entitlement crisis that doesn't really exist. So a lot of criticism of the economic discussion.
And well-deserved. So unfortunately, the 90s called and they said that they aren't still happening anymore, even though the questions were stuck in them.
The debt and Russia are no longer the biggest threats to America. This is not 1989.
Well, some might disagree with you on Russia, but, you know, that's not our show. Yeah. So also stuff going on with payday.
Yes. Today, Friday, we're recording this, and today is the big...
Stop telling people when we tape.
Spoiler. Today is the end of the comment period for the Obama administration's new rule to rein in payday loans, and a lot hangs in the balance here. You know, the original rule, it could exempt military people. It's still questionable how much it's going to regulate car title loans, which allows these lenders to seize people's cars. So we look forward to hearing what this final rule is.
And we'll be talking more about that later in the episode with Joe Valenti, who runs our consumer finance project here at CAP. So also some good news. Here's some good news from the Opportunity Agenda, who's been doing some polling on what Americans think about poverty.
Yeah. So for the first time in their new study this year, the study found that people actually – a majority of Americans are more likely to think that poverty is the fault of something outside of people's control rather than their own personal failings. So I think Americans are increasingly recognizing that poverty is not a moral failing. It's something that happens to people because of the situation they're in.
So with apologies to conservatives in Congress, personal responsibility might be going the way of, I don't know, what, pants with stirrups and leg warmers? Although those are kind of back.
Yeah. Or debt and Russia.
Debt and – okay. Or maybe just – yeah, wait. Okay. Well,
also kind of back, apparently.
Well, we'll come up with better references after we get off the air. Stuff going on at the American Enterprise Institute.
Yes.
What's AEI up to?
This is less optimistic. So AEI's latest event was an event called The Upside of Inequality, a discussion about whether good intentions undermine the middle class. And this is a discussion.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It sounds like you're telling me that AEI believes inequality is a good thing.
Well, you know, I don't want to. I'm not them, so I don't want to assume. But this is a new book written by a scholar there that basically argues that inequality does not slow growth, which I think the evidence is increasingly finding it does slow growth and reduce demand. And also that because of that, it is somehow morally okay. Neither of which I think most Americans would agree with.
Well, I'm looking forward to picking that one up at my local
your local Barnes & Noble, Politics and Prose.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. And lastly, Wells Fargo has been in the news.
Yes. not in a good way. So as many people know, the bank's employees created about 2 million fake accounts, everything from credit cards to checking accounts, to meet sales goals. And these were fake accounts. And there's a big push in Congress to push for actual prosecution of the top officials at Wells Fargo. Bernie Sanders is one of the leading advocates for this. And there's other discussion. Dodd-Frank actually gives the government the power to break up a bank, and Wells Fargo is the third biggest bank in the country now. So I think that this is moving the conversation on financial reform towards some real meaningful accountability.
So with that, we'll be heading over to a discussion about payday loans and how they exacerbate poverty, and also what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is trying to do about it. And then from there, a discussion about voter ID laws and a look ahead to November's election and who might be kept away from the polls.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Renee Bergeron, a single mother from Duluth, Minnesota, was between paychecks and took out a small payday loan to help cover her rent. Once her payday came around, after she paid her bills, there wasn't enough left over to repay the loan. So she took out another payday loan to pay it off, and then another. And nearly a decade later, Bergeron and her children live in a homeless shelter, and she remains saddled with more than $4,000 in payday loan debt. Regulators have begun to crack down on these kinds of predatory debt traps. And with me to discuss is Joe Valenti. He's the director of consumer finance here at the Center for American Progress. Joe, thank you for joining to talk about payday loans.
Absolutely. Glad to be here, Rebecca.
So I mentioned regulators. We'll talk a little bit about the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. But before we even get into some of the kinds of solutions that people are trying to advance right now, let's just start with, what's a payday loan?
Sure. So a payday loan is something that people turn to when they have too much month for the money.
Exactly.
And they want to try to make ends meet. But as John Oliver and Sarah Silverman put it a few months ago, it's kind of the worst possible option out there. So what happens is you go into one of these storefronts, big neon lights on the side of the highway that say fast cash now, or you go online. And as long as you've got a job and a bank account, they will probably lend you some money and say, hey, tell you what, you pay us back in a couple weeks. Next time you get paid, this is just to help you tide it over. The problem is they're charging an outrageous amount. It's typically 300, 400% interest if you look at what the cost could balloon to over the year. And the odds are really against you. Four out of five times, you're not actually in a position to pay that loan back in 2 weeks. And you end up having to take out another one and another one and another one. And if you're a struggling mom like Renee, all of a sudden, you're trying to keep up with this payday loan bill, and you're not able to keep up with all of your other bills.
So it starts with an amount that sounds manageable. The average payday loan is just about $375.
Right.
And so you can find yourself thinking, well, I can pay $375 when I get my next paycheck, right? So that's how this all starts. But break down 400% interest for me. It sounds like a big number, but what does that mean in terms of how much people end up paying just to have taken out that original $375 loan?
So for your $375 loan, the amount that the lender is going to tell you is probably going to be somewhere on the range of $50. So $375, okay, you're going to come back in 2 weeks with $425. The problem is most likely you're not going to have $425 in 2 weeks. It's going to take you 6 months in a lot of cases or longer to keep rolling this over and paying those fees. And so what sounds like a really manageable amount quickly gets out of control. So it's an annual interest calculation. Your credit card is probably 15, 20% interest, but that's the rate that's charged for the whole year. So you're paying something that's 10 or 20 times as much as somebody with a credit card would pay to get the same amount of money. And the lender is betting that you're not going to be able to pay it off and that they're just going to be able to keep taking money from you every 2 weeks as you show up and you're like, hey, I'm sorry, I can't pay the $425. And that's okay. Just give us another $50 and we'll tack it on. And the interest mounts till you could owe thousands of dollars in debt. I think about Naya Burks, a single mom in St. Louis who had irregular hours working in a chiropractor's office and took out a loan. It's a $1,000 loan. She couldn't keep up with it. It was 240% interest. She ended up $40,000 in debt. And it took a reporter investigating her case to get the payday lender to drop a lawsuit against to drop the lawsuit he'd filed against her.
And you're co-author on a new report that you put out this week about payday lending. Eliza Schultz, she wrote a piece for talkpoverty.org. And actually, as a feature with that piece is a video of a woman named Rebecca telling her own story. Let's listen to that for a second.
I think payday loans are designed to take advantage of low-income people of color who are oftentimes hardworking folks who have found themselves in tough situations. And these lenders take advantage of that and they exploit that. My parents don't even know that I was going to payday lenders just to make ends meet, right? And so, like, that's not the dream that they have for me. And so I have to believe that, you know, for the people that are doing everything right, they're playing by the rules, we need to make it right for those folks. And so if even in a small way, if there's a way to stop these loan sharks and, you know, shut them down or at least make it harder for them to steal billions of dollars from our community, then we have to do that.
Now, Rebecca, Renee Bergeron, all of these people, their stories are not unique. They're not even rare. As you report, these individuals are just a few of some 12 million borrowers who take out payday loans every single year. Tell me a little bit about what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, which is an agency charged with protecting the rights of consumers, they have taken action recently, and that's actually one of the reasons we're talking right now is because some of that is culminating this week. What is it that they've proposed to do?
So back in June, the CFPB announced rules to regulate payday lenders and other types of debt trap lenders at the federal level for the first time. States have been trying to fix this problem for years, if not decades, and they've run into enormous roadblocks doing that. So there's very comprehensive new rules coming out from CFPB, and the number one thing that they're requiring, which makes perfect sense to most people, is if you're a lender and you want to make a loan that seems kind of predatory, you should check and make sure the person can actually pay it back first and look over documentation and make sure that person has an ability to pay back that loan so that you get paid back and you're not putting someone in an even worse position. So they released a proposal back in June. They've been taking public comments throughout the summer. The public comment period closed on Friday, October 7th. When I looked, there were almost 200,000 comments that people had filed with the CFPB about the rule. The final number is probably going to be a lot higher. Now, that's going to be a mix of pro and con. A lot of people have been hurt by these products. A lot of advocates are really concerned, but also there are a lot of people who may walk into a payday loan store and they want to take out a loan and they're told, hey, you know, while you're in here, why don't you write a little note about why this product is important to you and tell your story? And so there's probably a fair number of comments that are also astroturf by struggling people who feel like they really need the money and they're told that they should say something to be able to keep that predatory product alive.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, right? So, devil's advocate, maybe these products are really expensive. Maybe in some cases, as you describe, people end up trapped in cycles of debt. But aren't they serving a necessary purpose? Aren't people cash strapped and clearly in need of someone to give them a little bit of money so that they don't get evicted or are able to pay their bills?
So we've got a great experiment in that 14 states in D.C. don't have these products. They're not legal. where 90 million Americans live. And by and large, they get by just fine. Even if you look at a state like Arkansas, where these products were only taken off the market a few years ago, only 12% of former borrowers say, hey, this is something that I miss. Because the odds are so stacked against you. I always go back to Elizabeth Warren. Before she was a senator, she was a professor studying bankruptcy and how people get into financial trouble. And she would say, you know, if you had a toaster and one out of five people had their toasters explode, we would take that off the market. For whatever reason, we're reluctant to do that when it comes to finances. But four out of five borrowers aren't able to pay back the loan on time.
So it's actually four out of five toasters that are exploding.
Right. And for some, they're burning your house down. If you go to look at people who take out payday loans on the internet, one in four will end up having their bank account closed because the lender just keeps trying to dip in and take money out to get paid back. If you look at people who take out title loans, it's a close cousin to a payday loan where you basically pawn your car title. And if you don't pay, they can take your car. One in five borrowers loses the car to repossession. So the risks are so great that it's really important for somebody to step in. And let's be clear, this is part of a pattern. This is something that didn't exist in a lot of states until about 20 years ago. If you look at a state like Ohio, the number of lenders that they had between 1995 and 2005 went up 15 times. They had a few handfuls, and then all of a sudden there are thousands.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about how we got here, right? So anyone who's seen John Oliver's excellent treatment of this issue was probably struck by the statistic that today we have more payday storefronts around the country than we have McDonald's, right? Which when you think about how many McDonald's there are and you see them everywhere you go, it's kind of an amazing thing to think. But how did we get to this point? What fueled the rise of payday lending? And I want to start with some of the legal kind of pieces of the puzzle. You mentioned Ohio, but there were some court cases. There were changes in legislation and regulation. Walk us through what brought us here legally.
So a few things that happened. First is 1978. There's a court case by the Supreme Court, the Marquette decision, that said that it didn't matter what interest rates were allowed in the state where you lived, that the interest rate that you could be charged was determined by where the bank lived, not where you lived. So banks started moving to states that said, hey, you could charge whatever interest rate you want. And so all of a sudden you see these state interest rate laws that had been around in some cases since before the revolution that said, hey, you can't charge more than 5 or 10 or 15% interest. All of a sudden these state laws aren't as effective as they used to be. And you see financial deregulation going on in the years that followed through the 80s and 90s. And in the 90s, you see this kind of cottage industry that evolves that decides to take advantage of people who don't have the wages that they should. If you look at what the minimum wage would be today, it should be well over $10 if adjusted for inflation. It's still $7.25 at the federal level. They looked at people who no longer had access to the same kind of safety net that we could take for granted in prior decades. And they saw an opportunity that they could get rich quick by offering people promises of getting by on credit when their financial situations were much worse than they had been in years past.
And so you also, in the course of telling that legal story, mentioned the economic conditions part of the puzzle. As your report describes, stagnant and declining wages for not just low-income Americans, but actually folks well up the income spectrum played a role as well. But I also want to focus a little bit on the safety net, which you just brought up, because obviously regulating this industry, which the CFPB is seeking to do, and as you mentioned, states are seeking to do, although having challenges doing, that's one piece of the puzzle. But does the safety net play a role, and should policymakers be looking to strengthen safety net programs so that people don't need to turn to payday loans?
Absolutely. And going back to the John Oliver piece, there's an ad, it's a little raunchy, but Sarah Silverman does this fake commercial for anything else as the alternative to payday loans. And that's really what it's about. It's not just credit. It's about being able to rely on friends and family and churches and the safety net. And for a lot of low-income families, that's increasingly hard to do. Here's one example. Before welfare reform, we had a federal emergency assistance program. And if you adjusted the numbers pre-welfare reform to inflation, that would be about $1.4 billion today, each year, that was available for emergency assistance in 1995. Today, the combined state and federal funds for emergency assistance, and some states don't even have these programs at all, adds up to about $865 million. So that's just a little over half what we were offering people in financial distress 20 years ago. And this is just one symptom of so many cases where we've rolled back the safety net, we've blocked granted programs, we've given states flexibility to do things that have nothing to do with meeting people's personal crises and financial crises into an environment where it's harder to get help from other sources when you need it. And people are turning to credit as a safety net that really doesn't work very well.
So in the last minute I have with you, what can we expect to see in the weeks and months ahead with respect to the CFPB's proposed rule? Where can folks go to learn more?
Sure. To learn more, you can go to Talk Poverty and look at everything you want to know about payday loans, but were afraid to ask, by my colleague Eliza. It's going to take a few months for the CFPB to read through these hundreds of thousands of comments, and probably sometime next year they'll come out with a rule. At the same time, we have to pay attention to what happens with a budget deal, because some folks in Congress have been trying really hard to block the CFPB from taking action on this or on other issues that really matter to working families. And so there may be attempts in Congress to defang the rule or do other things to make it really hard to go after these predatory lenders.
Joe Valenti is the Director of Consumer Finance at the Center for American Progress and a former member of the same competitive karaoke team I was part of, Vocal Opposition, which took second place citywide earlier this year. You may know his voice and his dulcet tones from that experience. Joe, thank you so much for talking to Talk Poverty Radio.
Absolutely. And we are vocally opposed to the payday debt trap.
Well done. Nice close there.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. In November, 14 states will have voting restrictions in place for the first time in a presidential election since a 2013 Supreme Court case that eviscerated federal protections against voter suppression. Many of these states will require their residents to show a photo ID. To discuss why this matters and the impact that it may have for civic engagement across the population, I'm joined by Liz Kennedy, Director of Democracy and Other Fabulous Things at the Center for American Progress, and Laura Durso, Senior Director of LGBT Progress. Thank you, ladies, for joining me, two of my favorite people on the 10th floor.
Always good to be here, Rebecca.
It's a pleasure.
So, Liz, I'm going to go to you first to give us sort of a sense of the landscape here, right? People bring up photo ID, and often the refrain is, well, we need it to prevent voter fraud. Is that true? Does that hold water? If so, why not?
Yeah, really not at all, Rebecca. And here's why. Voter fraud is vanishingly rare. And the only you are more likely to be hit by lightning than for there to be actually proved cases of voter impersonation fraud. And that's the only type of fraud that would even be addressed through these strict photo ID requirements.
If somebody voter impersonation fraud, it sounds like it would be I show up to the polling place and I say, my name is Liz Kennedy. I'd like to cast a ballot, please. And they're like, oh, this way, Ms. Kennedy, but I'm not Liz Kennedy. I'm impersonating Liz Kennedy.
That's exactly right. So first of all, the real problem here is that we don't have enough voter participation in this country. In 2014, voter participation was at the lowest rate in 72 years. So we don't have a real problem where people are trying to vote too frequently. We have a problem where not enough eligible citizens are presenting themselves, having their voices heard at the polls. And that's because, unfortunately, our system has been set up in a way that is actually keeping people from exercising their power and electing their governments and really having their voices heard. And these new forms of voter suppression measures are really doing an even worse job, making it even harder for so many of our fellow citizens to actually exercise their rights as American citizens to cast a ballot.
So walk us through what's going on, right? We've got a bunch of states that are now going to be putting new, in some cases, untested restrictions in place at the polls. Some of these are swing states. Mm-hmm. Why does this matter? What do we think is going to happen in November?
Sure. So it matters for a number of reasons. I think the first and foremost reason that we have to remember is that voting is an individual right. Everyone should have a right to cast a ballot and have their voice heard so that there are exercise in self-government reflects everyone's opinion. So really, the integrity of our elections should be measured by whether every eligible American can cast a ballot that is counted. It is also collectively very problematic because when you are imposing further restrictions on who is able to cast a ballot, those burdens lie differently on different communities. So, for example, when you referenced the 2013 case that now has really removed federal protections and allowed so many of these states to move forward with these really strict suppressive measures, we find that this kind of strict photo ID in Texas, 600,000 people of color did not have the required voter ID that the state was saying was acceptable. These states are deciding only a certain kind of identification would be accepted at the polls. Texas, for example, allowing a concealed handgun permit, but not a student ID. So these are very targeted restrictions. In Wisconsin, we see 300,000 Wisconsin citizens do not have the required documentation to present themselves at the polls. And again, they're eligible voters. They are American citizens. They are of age. They are residents. It is all of the things that are required to be eligible. But then there's another additional hurdle that some people are being asked to cross. And just because some people have ID does not mean that everyone has ID. So we see that elderly citizens are less likely to possess government-issued photo identification. Maybe these folks don't drive anymore. Maybe they don't have a driver's license that is still a valid driver's license. As many as 11% of U.S. citizens don't have these photo IDs. Citizens with comparatively low incomes are far less likely to possess documentation of either citizenship or of their just proof of identification. And again, this is a red herring. This idea that these things actually solve any real problem of voter fraud isn't the case. The way that these are now affecting the integrity of our elections is that they are keeping our fellow Americans from having their voices heard at the polls. And that is something that really we should all be taking as a burden on all of our equal citizenship.
So a recent article in The Washington Post bore the headline, and I feel like this sums up nicely what you just said. Getting a photo ID so you can vote is easy. Unless you're poor, Black, Latino, or elderly, and that's just to name a few of the subgroups that are less likely to have identification. But one of the groups not mentioned in that headline, and Laura Durso, I want to bring you in on this, is LGBT individuals. Are LGBT folks another subgroup that is less likely to have ID? I think I'm asking that question knowing the answer, because otherwise I wouldn't have you here.
Well, it's a great question, because your listeners might be thinking, why is this an LGBT issue?
Why am I here?
And I'm glad that we are, because, you know, there's a number of reasons, and I think you're absolutely right, that LGBT Americans fall into one of the groups where voter suppression efforts and, you know, erecting barriers to the voting booth, you know, will have a disproportionate impact. That's for a couple of reasons. One is for a reason that Liz mentioned, which is when you're talking, you know, when you look at the populations that are affected, we're talking about young people, we're talking about communities of color. LGBT people are more likely to be young people, are more likely to be within communities of color. And so just on its face, we're looking at major impacts to the LGBT community just because of who we all are. And then even within that, you have to take a look at, okay, well, who has access to identification and what barriers might there be that are unique to the community? And we absolutely know that there will be a significant disproportionate impact on transgender people, on gender nonconforming people, for a number of reasons. And I think it's important for, you know, us to talk this through. So one of those things is simply getting access to the right forms of identification. So the best data we have demonstrate that the vast majority of transgender people are not able to obtain documentation that lists their a correct gender identity. So now we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are not going to be able to walk into a voting booth and show an ID that shows their gender identity. There's a great estimate out of the Williams Institute. I will give a shout out to my long distance work wife, Dr. Jody Herman, who put a number on that, estimating the impacts of these voter suppression laws that you've talked about. 34,000 citizens who are eligible to vote, who are likely going to be kept from the polls. And that's in terms of being able to access certain forms of identification that meet these requirements. But again, there are barriers already to getting IDs. And then the second thing I think is important to bring up is actually thinking about the act of going to vote. So you go in to vote, now you're being asked to show ID. So you have to, one, have been able to get it. And then two, be able to show it to a poll worker who's going to make a judgment call about whether you are who you say you are. And so now if I'm presenting an identification that either lists the wrong gender marker, that is a picture that does not look like who I am and how I'm presenting, and this is true for trans people, this is true for gender nonconforming people, or, you know, hey, if I look different in that, like, I'm heavier than I used to be. And so, like, the picture, like, we're giving somebody.
Your hair right now is a little redder.
My hair is different.
And shorter than it was.
And I don't mean to make a joke out of it, but, you know, but, like,
These are real things.
Talk about what we're actually asking people to do. We're asking volunteers to take a look at someone's identification and decide if they are who they say they are. Mm-hmm. And we know that this is going to open people up to harassment and to denials of the voting booth. So we have some great data from the National Transgender Discrimination Survey. 41% of trans people report being harassed, 15% report being asked to leave, and 3% report being assaulted or attacked when they have presented identification that does not match their gender identity. We are talking about not only being blocked from the voting booth because of being unable to access ID, but then in that poll location being turned away or harassed because people think that they aren't who they say they are.
So the voice of support of photo ID laws, right? And I like to not just put up straw men. I like to actually name them and sometimes shame them. I think this one deserves shame. Hans von Spakovsky, everyone's favorite sort of, you know, demon here on a lot of issues, actually, not just these, right? He also is behind a lot of the rise of myths when it comes to gun ownership and how easy it should be to get guns. He also was behind a lot to do with Affordable Care Act rhetoric. So Hans von Spakovsky, voters who have to show ID constantly in their everyday lives certainly don't see ID as a problem, right? But you're telling me that that is not necessarily the lived experience of an entire and tremendously sizable subgroup of this population.
Yep. I mean, we have roughly a million trans people in this country, and they all may be petrified to go to the polls because they're going to be clocked as trans and they're going to be turned away or worse.
Mm-hmm. And that's adding to the really unfortunate and irresponsible rhetoric around poll watching that we've seen in this election season. Candidates saying, you know, cast your ballot, but then go watch the polls, check out if there's cheating in some areas. And you really have to ask, well, what are you watching for? Is it just person of color. You know, these are real scare tactics, and this is real fear mongering that is behind so much of the public facing rhetoric around these laws. And yet, for example, in North Carolina, and the Fourth Circuit decision that struck down the North Carolina monster voter suppression bill found that the state legislature asked for racial use data of certain types of voting avenues, same day registration, other pieces, and then surgically removed those types of voter access rather than, for example, tightening rules around absentee ballots. And they waited until after the Shelby decision, waited until after the protections of the Voting Rights Act were removed.
The Shelby decision being the 2013 Supreme Court case we mentioned before.
Exactly. And then said, now we are going to move forward with the full bill. They went after their North Carolina neighbors, their voters of color, Black voters, specifically in North Carolina. And these are really tools that are meant to protect the status quo in power and meant to keep the rising American electorate from using their power at the ballot box. And so it has collective problems, but it has individual problems when then any individual person is saying, I was going to vote for the first time this year, you know, as a young person, but now my college ID isn't going to be allowed. In Wisconsin, they are saying you can use your, if a student is using a college ID, they also have to bring proof of enrollment, such as a class schedule or a tuition receipt. These are just unnecessary barriers and burdens for the purpose of keeping people away from the polls, some people.
Certain people.
And it will, you know, we have real concerns about how many people are not going to be able to access the polls this year. I'll just say in Ohio, which unfortunately now no longer has a week where you can register and vote in that same week. It was called Golden Week, and the Sixth Circuit allowed Ohio to get rid of it over a strenuous dissent from appellate Judge Keith, who wrote a tremendous, blistering dissent saying these are the same tactics. The tactics change, but the goal is the same. He had pictures of martyrs killed in the civil rights struggle in his dissent, in his Sixth Circuit opinion, because Ohio removed this week. And 80,000 Ohioans voted in that week in 2012. It was almost 1.5% of all the votes cast in the election, and the margin of victory in that election was 3%. So these are really targeted, and they have real impacts for the communities at large, for the future of our country, and for the individuals who feel silenced or who have to overcome all these burdens and harassments to actually participate.
Yeah, Liz, I'm glad you brought up the rhetoric around this as well, because I think that to sort of broaden this out even for an LGBT issue, I think it's another example of how anti-LGBT equality opponents, did I just do a double negative?
You did.
Our opponents. I think everyone understands what I mean.
Opponents of the opponents progress of equality, that your team is
Friday
for
let's,
in its name.
Let's just go for it. You know, opponents of equality and states in particular, and you brought up North Carolina, which is a great example of this right now. It's another example of the state rejecting the dignity of transgender people. They are very literally saying, we don't believe you. You are a fraud. It sort of plays into this notion that gender identity is this, you know, indefinable construct, that transgender people are committing fraud against the public by deciding one day to like be something that they're not. And it really plays into that rhetoric. And that is also a thing that enables discrimination against the community. And I think it's just dangerous all around that the idea here is that we're meant to be fearful of each other and meant to everyone is suspect. And that's how we end up with the levels of violence that we see against the community. And so you're absolutely right that there is also this rhetorical element to it as well, that has broader implications than just what's happening in the voting booth.
Now, Liz Kennedy, to go back to you for a minute, I want to sort of go back in time just a little bit and sort of help understand how we got to this place of having this surge of Republican-led state legislatures passing laws requiring photo IDs, because that's what we've seen in recent years. This was timed with President Obama taking office. Is that a coincidence? Tell us a little bit of the story at the state level of how we got to where we are.
Sure. And I think I would take it even further back, Rebecca, because the rise in rhetoric around these questions of voter fraud and the politicization of repoliticization, I should say, but of voting rights and voting access, we really saw a rise in that after the 2000 elections. Mm. So after the 2000 elections, which, by the way, before a lot of people were paying attention, Florida purged tens of thousands of people that they had, mostly people of color, that they had inaccurately tagged as potentially felons. Tens of thousands, far more than, again, the
dangling chads.
The margin, A, the chads, or B, the margin when the Supreme Court finally stopped the counting of votes in that election.
Sorry, I just like to say dangling chad whenever I get the opportunity. And that was an opportunity.
May She's you here never have that opportunity again.
Here every week.
going forward into this election, I hope that we don't have the 2016 version of dangling chads.
You or and me both.
The butterfly ballot. But we really should be aware. So if we're talking our history, we have got to look back at the ways in which the electorate was really shaped in terms of who was able to participate in the 2000 election. It was after the 2000 election that the Department of Justice, you mentioned Hans von Spakovsky, at that point a member of the Department of Justice, went on a tear trying to find, leaving no stone unturned, to seek these voting fraud cases, to build a case to support these laws. They failed to do that. The Bush Department of Justice spent much time and fired U.S. attorneys over the issue of whether they were appropriately vigorous in their prosecution of, you know, non-existent voter fraud claims and issues. So that's where they were. Some states started passing these voter identification laws. Indiana was one. That went up through the Seventh Circuit and then to the Supreme Court. And in a case called Crawford, the Supreme Court upheld the photo identification. However, the Indiana law was very broad, and they said, well, gee, if you're really protecting the integrity of elections against voter fraud, I guess you can require this slight other thing. Since then, Judge Posner on the Seventh Circuit essentially recanted, said, you know what, you guys were right. I should have recognized this is a voter suppressive tactic. After the increase in political participation by communities of color, particularly the African-American voting rate was basically on par, achieved parity with the white voting rate in 2008, and in some states like North Carolina started surpassing it. And that's then when, after the 2010 elections, when so many state legislators changed hands, they had the green light from the Supreme Court, they had all the political power, and they had this, essentially kind of race-based fear, and were able to then instead turn back and put these facially neutral, yet racially discriminatory and, you know, unevenly discriminatory on other communities as well, you know, voting restrictions. And that is why we had Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. That is why, if we want to talk history, going back to 1965, you know, states had been keeping people of color from the polls for centuries and then decades after Reconstruction. Some of that history is still with us in terms of felon disenfranchisement laws. Florida disenfranchising one in four of its African American citizens, not eligible to cast a ballot just because of a past felony conviction.
And that's before you even talk about whether they have photo ID.
And that's before you even talk about photo ID. And that's before in 2012, Florida was famously caught trying to purge 187,000 named people in Florida had been tagged as potentially felons with this just bad data matching, essentially. So it's, you know, it's rife. It's everywhere. It is absolutely targeted towards racial groups. It lands unevenly on all groups. It is a question of kind of who deserves deserves to have their voice heard versus we don't care if other people are kept away. And that is not the America that we need to be building towards. We absolutely have tools where we can restore the Voting Rights Act, first and foremost, and we should be automatically registering people that the state already knows are eligible to vote, like Oregon is currently doing.
And I want to talk a little bit about some of the solutions, but basically the picture you've just painted, I think, perfectly explains why it is not histrionic, but completely fair when individuals like former Attorney General Eric Holder refer to photo ID restrictions in the voting context as a poll tax, right? Yeah. Again, referring to the history that you just described.
It's not histrionic, it's historical. Like, let's not get ahistorical about the attempts to maintain, you know, political power in white property owners' male hands. You know, so we have a history of this throughout our country. We've had expanses, you know, periods where we are expanding access, where we are recognizing the equality and the dignity, you know, of all of the people in this country. And then we have periods of retrenchment. So we have been in a period of retrenchment. I think that there is enough attention being paid to some of these cases that hopefully we are able to move forward, depoliticize this question of voting rights, because honestly, we need, you know, people should be able to have disagreements on policy and politics, and the elections and at the ballot is where we make those decisions together as a political community. And everyone has a voice and everyone gets to raise their hand and say, I support this, I support that. Then we form a self-government, then we move forward from there. The idea, instead of voters choosing their politicians, that politicians are choosing their voters by blocking some people from even having their voices heard, is really un-American. And I think more and more people are understanding that in North Carolina, coming together around some of these issues, in Wisconsin certainly as well. So we do just need to, it's a constant fight we've seen. So we need to keep that awareness.
So Laura Durso, we've been talking for the last few minutes about sort of the racial impacts and some of the racial history, and it's hard to have this conversation without telling that story. But I'm struck that many of the Republican-led state legislatures that have passed these kinds of laws are also the same states that have been enacting policies that are incredibly discriminatory against and indeed target LGBT individuals. Do you see that being the next wave of this kind of voter suppression?
Yeah, I think we're in it, to forget even like next wave. I think that's
the current wave.
The current wave, right, is for, and I do believe that on at least on our side of things, I think it's an indication of the LGBT community actually winning, that states have moved so quickly to try and restrict rights in as many places as they can. I hope that that's maybe true for your issues as well, Liz. But, you know, so I think, you know, one of the things that Liz and I have talked about in the hallways here is what states are doing. You know, one of the themes that kind of cuts across all of these things is restricting access to public life, to being a citizen and restricted access to public life. So the fact that we'll come back to North Carolina because they are the big offender right now, you know, that they are restricting access to public spaces for transgender people. So the polling place is one of those things, but essentially every other public place within the state, right? So this, I think that is an important theme that these states are undertaking to really undercut equality in so many ways. And I think, you know, voter suppression, as we're talking about here, is an LGBT issue because it affects us as people, because it affects our friends. And also I think that it's something that if you look at the way that public opinion shifts have happened on LGBT equality issues, you know, I would posit, and I don't have data to show this today, but I would love to figure this out. You know, the act of suppressing the vote, which differentially impacts young people, communities of color, and those are also the pockets where we see support for LGBT equality. And so what does it mean to restrict our friends from going to the polls to help us, to elect pro-equality candidates, to vote with us on ballot initiatives? You know, I don't mean to say that the LGBT community should care about voter suppression because we stand to benefit if those folks can get to the polls. But I do think it's important to think about how progressive agendas move forward. And certainly LGBT equality is part of the progressive agenda. And so what are these policy impacts that then happen because we are keeping people from the polls? It isn't just that we're restricting people from being able to walk into a polling place, but then what policy agendas are not being implemented that would, you know, do things like reform the criminal justice system. So we're not talking about kicking felons, you know, removing their right to vote. That's only something that changes because of policy. And if you can't vote in the people that are going to do that, you know, we're all screwed. So, I hope I can say that on air.
You said it beautifully and without any of the words that we're not allowed to say on air.
Great.
So well done.
Thank you.
I want to dig in the last few minutes that we have right before we get to solutions. We're going to get to solutions. I promise we are. But this is related. This is on point. I promise. You're both looking at me like, yes, solutions. You mentioned, though, the barriers to accessing and participating in public life. And we're talking about voting because, of course, we are. November feels like it's minutes away and everyone's thinking about very little else than Election Day. But and not having a photo identification, for example, can be a tremendous barrier to participating in public life. And this is particularly the case for low-income individuals, whether it's needing to access public benefits or getting housing, the greater level of scrutiny and regulation applied to their lives. That's something that your team has looked at in particular, looking at the intersection of LGBT identity and being low-income or even homelessness. Tell me a little bit about some of what you guys have found and about the role of ID in some of those issues.
Absolutely. Credit where credit is due. My colleagues, Hannah Hussey, Shabab Mirza, have worked on this issue. Again, to point out exactly what you're saying, which is that IDs are not only important so that we can go vote, but that we have access to a public library, that we can get benefits that are rightfully ours that our communities are offering. So we have taken a look at the barriers that exist to accessing IDs for young people who are homeless. So this is not just for LGBT people, though obviously we have a stake in that. But this is true for low-income folks and young people in particular. And we looked at all 50 states and what kind of barriers are in place and how might we remove those barriers. And I won't get to solutions yet if you don't want me to. But to throw up some of the barriers, right? So as we're talking about with trans communities, it's getting the right ID in the first place. And there are a number of states that are doing the right kinds of things in terms of how easily accessible the process is to change your gender marker, for example, on your driver's license. There are good states that are doing the right thing where that's concerned. Unfortunately, of course, there are also awful states. There's the National Center for Transgender Equality has a grading system for how easy it is for trans people to update their driver's license. And if you look at the states that have D's and F's, there's roughly 18 states and four territories that are really making it hard for trans people to access the right identification, have overly burdensome regulations and requirements there. And that's really true, too, when you're talking about people who are low income, who are maybe homeless. So we looked at, for example, how many states offer free or reduced cost identification if you are experiencing homelessness. It's only 22% of states that allow for that to happen. You can have waivers, but only, unfortunately, 22% of states do that. There are roughly half the states require consent from a parent or legal guardian in order to obtain an ID card, and that can be a total non-starter for young people who have been kicked out of their homes, or who are estranged from their families of origin, and those people who would sign off on that request for an ID. So that's a huge issue for people as well. And states just sort of make it really opaque and impossible to figure out a system. So we counted up that around 12 states have no procedure that we can find for helping people access IDs if they're experiencing homelessness. So there are these pretty simple to remove barriers to accessing identification that we really think would have a disproportionate and positive impact on young people experiencing homelessness and by extension, LGBT young people as well.
So, solutions. Let's do it.
Yeah.
I promised we were going to do it. I meant it. We're here. So, Liz, I think some of that sets us up with what we need. But what is it that what policies do we need to be putting in place? What protections do we need?
Yeah.
Where do we go from here?
Yeah. So I do think that one thing that we should remember is the power that individuals have in our society when they do come together and register and vote. So, A, you talked about November being around the corner. early voting has already begun in a lot of states. So by all means, check out if your state has early voting and go cast your ballot already. Then you can spend election day, you know, driving other people to the polls to vote for whomever they vote for. And it's also registration deadlines are right around the corner. So, for example, in Ohio, the registration deadline is this Monday. Also important to note, it is this Tuesday. Also important to note, registration deadlines in Florida, even though the state is now being hit by a hurricane that we hope everyone is safely riding out, safely and dryly riding out.
Including my grandparents, whom I love dearly and hope are okay.
My sister lives in Haiti. So she and her family are fine.
Whoa.
Yay.
Oh,
yeah. So the, not to one up who's where, but it's definitely, we're all worried about the hurricane.
I know what you did there. I'm not going to lie.
It's a true story. It's a personal story, but that's, I've certainly been thinking about
the
hurricane.
We all love our family. I love mine more, but
exactly.
That's okay.
We're going to take that off air, you guys, and we'll come back.
I'll meet you outside after this segment.
I'll meet you downstairs. But the point is that, unfortunately, the governor of that state has not extended the voter registration deadline, even though in the last week in 2012, something like 50,000 Floridians registered to vote right in the last few days. Now everyone is instead, you know, making sure that they're safe in the storm.
As they should be.
And not exactly. But, you know, and we can't just have a few more days where they will also be able to make sure that they're registered so that their voices are heard. So that being said, so we need to remove the state-based barriers to participation. We should also, however, remember that we shouldn't boo. Everybody should go vote. Right now, unfortunately, 41% of Latinos, this is from last year, so certainly those numbers have now changed, but it used to be that 41% of Latinos not registered to vote, 44% of Asian Americans not registered to vote, 46% of 18 to 20-year-olds not even registered to vote. So we need to make sure to personally take these, you know, and 37% of low-income people making under $30,000 a year not registered to vote. Those are obviously huge swaths of these communities. And, you know, while so many people have really awoken to the power of protest and getting in the streets on these issues, we have to remember that voting is itself a strategic use of political power. And so I think that that is something that people really need to think about. The government should be making it should be facilitating participation, because that is really the measure of the legitimacy of a democracy that is based on the consent of the governed, is that everybody come together to make those decisions. So again, automatic voter registration is something where, since the states, particularly with Real ID, actually already know that you have proven your citizenship status and your name and your residence and all of these other things at the DMV or the social other social services agencies. These need to be equitable programs, but that could be a transformative effort that could really bring so many more people into the system. And then we can do deep canvassing to make sure that there's the person-to-person contact to really build those communities and the understanding that the power is in our hands if we use it.
And you mentioned disenfranchisement of people with criminal records. Obviously, registration is just one piece of the puzzle. We also need to remove barriers to eligibility for citizens who have been disenfranchised.
Absolutely. It's now 6.1 million people. The Sentencing Project just recently upped the numbers from 5.85 to 6.1 million. Again, mostly those are in four or five states where it's over 20% of their populations. And Florida is the worst measure there. And, you know, so many of these questions for the country, you know, relate to individual state based decision making in our electoral college. So that's just really a big problem. And then I would say, if we're talking solutions, it is absolutely a national disgrace that the Voting Rights Act, which stood for 50 years as the country's prime achievement after the hard fought bloody battles of the civil rights movement, of all of the individuals that were marching and facing, you know, the hoses and the dogs and the horses and et cetera, that so many people now have gone to Selma to commemorate the memory, but they've not yet moved it in Congress. So they should be doing that the second that they get back in November, is restoring the Voting Rights Act. There are two bills in Congress, and there is no excuse Courts have clearly found these measures to be not just the burden racially discriminatory, but in several states, intentionally racially discriminatory. And we need to reinstall some federal protections so that those burdens are not just on the individual voters who are facing this.
So for listeners who want to figure out how they can get registered to vote and where their polling place might be, where should one go?
They can call 866-OUR-VOTE, the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition. There is a website, 866-OUR-VOTE. There is a phone number that is live, people standing by to answer your questions, 866-OUR-VOTE. There is also a bilingual option being offered in both Spanish and Asian American and Pacific Islander languages. And if people do encounter questions or issues at the polls, please do call that in. The Department of Justice will also be standing by, although with less expanded powers because of the Shelby decision. We'll get into that the next time. But it's very important that individual voters be the eyes and ears. Go vote, bring your friends, check your registration. This is the year, this is the time. Go now.
Liz Kennedy is the Director of Democracy and Other Fabulous Things, as I have retitled her, at the Center for American Progress. Laura Durso is the Senior Director of LGBT Progress. And I love my family the most. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block.